The Eye of Osiris by R. Austin Freeman. Chapter 18, Part 2. It was all clear enough so far. The peculiar sound that filled the air was the hum of the interrupter. The bulb was, of course, a Crookes tube, and the red spot inside it the glowing red-hot disk of the anti-cathode. Clearly, an X-ray photograph was being made. But of what? I strained my eyes, peering into the gloom at the foot of the gallows. But though I could make out an elongated object lying on the floor directly under the bulb, I could not resolve the dimly seen shape into anything recognizable. Presently, however, Dr. Norbury supplied the clue.
"I am rather surprised," said he, "that you chose so composite an object as a mummy to begin on. I should have thought that a simpler object, such as a coffin or wooden figure, would have been more instructive."
"In some ways it would," replied Thorndyke. "But the variety of materials that the mummy gives us has its advantages. I hope your father is not ill, Miss Bellingham."
"He is not at all well," said Ruth, "and we agreed that it was better for me to come alone. I knew Herr Lederbogen quite well. He stayed with us for a time when he was in England."
"I trust," said Dr. Norbury, "that I have not troubled you for nothing. Herr Lederbogen speaks of our erratic English friend with a long name that I can never remember, and it seemed to me that he might be referring to your uncle."
"I should hardly have called my uncle erratic," said Ruth.
"No, no, certainly not," Dr. Norbury agreed hastily. "However, you shall see the letter presently and judge for yourself. We mustn't introduce irrelevant topics while an experiment is in process, must we, Doctor?"
"You had better wait until we have finished," said Thorndyke, "because I am going to turn out the light. Switch off the current, Polton." The green light vanished from the bulb. The hum of the interrupter swept down an octave or two and died away. Then Thorndyke and Dr. Norbury rose from their chairs and went towards the mummy, which they lifted tenderly, while Polton drew from beneath it what presently turned out to be a huge black paper and envelope. The single glow lamp was switched off, leaving the room in total darkness, until there burst out suddenly a bright orange-red light immediately above one of the trays. We all gathered round to watch, as Polton, the high priest of these mysteries, drew from the black envelope a colossal sheet of bromide paper, laid it carefully in the tray, and proceeded to wet it with a large brush which he had dipped in a pail of water.
"I thought you always used plates for this kind of work," said Dr. Norbury.
"Oh, we do, by preference, but a 6-foot plate would be impossible. So I had a special paper made to the size." There is something singularly fascinating in the appearance of a developing photograph, in the gradual, mysterious emergence of the picture from the blank white surface of plate or paper. But a skiagraph or X-ray photograph has a fascination all its own. Unlike an ordinary photograph, which yields a picture of things already seen, it gives a presentment of objects hitherto invisible. And hence, when Polton poured the developer on the already wet paper, we all craned over the tray with the keenest curiosity. The developer was evidently a very slow one. For fully half a minute, no change could be seen in the uniform surface. Then, gradually, almost insensibly, the marginal portion began to darken, leaving the outline of the mummy in pale relief. The change, once started, proceeded apace. Darker and darker grew the margin of the paper, until from slaty gray it had turned to black. And still, the shape of the mummy, now in strong relief, remained an elongated patch of bald white. But not for long. Presently, the white shape began to be tinged with gray,
and as the color deepened, there grew out of it a paler form that seemed to steal out of the enshrouding gray like an apparition, spectral, awesome, mysterious. The skeleton was coming into view.
"It is rather uncanny," said Dr. Norbury. "I feel as if I were assisting at some unholy rite. Now, just look at it now."
The gray shadow of the cartonnage, the wrappings, and the flesh was fading away into the black background, and the white skeleton stood out in sharp contrast, and it certainly was a rather weird spectacle.
"You'll lose the bones if you develop much farther," said Dr. Norbury.
"I must let the bones darken," Thorndyke replied, "in case there are any metallic objects. I have 3 more papers in the envelope." The white shape of the skeleton now began to gray over, and, as Dr. Norbury had said, its distinctness became less and less. Thorndyke leaned over the tray with his eyes fixed on a point in the middle of the breast, and we all watched him in silence. Suddenly he rose.
"Now, Poulton," he said sharply, "get the hypo on as quickly as you can."
Poulton, who had been waiting with his hand on the stopcock of the drain tube, rapidly ran off the developer into a bucket and flooded the paper with the fixing solution.
"Now we can look at it at our leisure," said Thorndyke.
After waiting a few seconds, he switched on one of the glow lamps, and as the flood of light fell on the photograph, he added,
"You see, we haven't quite lost the skeleton."
"No." Dr. Norbury put on a pair of spectacles and bent down over the tray. And at this moment, I felt Ruth's hand touch my arm, lightly at first, and then with a strong, nervous grasp, and I could feel that her hand was trembling. I looked round at her anxiously and saw that she had turned deathly pale.
"Would you rather go out into the gallery?" I asked, for the room with its tightly shut windows was close and hot.
"No," she replied quietly.
"I will stay here. I am quite well."
But still, she kept hold of my arm. Thorndyke glanced at her keenly and then looked away as Dr. Norbury turned to him to ask a question.
"Why is it, think you, that some of the teeth show so much whiter than others?"
"I think the whiteness of the shadows is due to the presence of metal," Thorndyke replied.
"Do you mean that the teeth have metal fillings?" asked Dr. Norbury.
"Yes."
"Really? This is very interesting. The use of gold stoppings, and artificial teeth too, by the ancient Egyptians is well known, but we have no examples in the museum. This mummy ought to be unrolled. Do you think all those teeth are filled with the same metal? They are not equally white."
"No," replied Thorndyke. "Those teeth that are perfectly white are undoubtedly filled with gold, but that grayish one is probably filled with tin."
"Very interesting," said Dr. Norbury. "Very interesting. And what do you make of that faint mark across the chest, near the top of the sternum?"
It was Ruth who answered the question.
"It is the Eye of Osiris," she exclaimed in a hushed voice.
"Dear me," exclaimed Dr. Norbury. "So it is. You are quite right. It is the Utchat, the Eye of Horus, or Osiris, if you prefer to call it so. That, I presume, will be a gilded device on some of the wrappings."
"No, I should say it is a tattoo mark. It is too indefinite for a gilded device. And I should say further that the tattooing is done in vermilion, as carbon tattooing would cast no visible shadow."
"I think you must be mistaken about that," said Dr. Norbury. "But we shall see if the director allows us to unroll the mummy. By the way, those little objects in front of the knees are metallic, I suppose?"
"Yes, they are metallic, but they are not in front of the knees, they are in the knees. They are pieces of silver wire which have been used to repair fractured kneecaps."
"Are you sure of that?" exclaimed Dr. Norbury,
peering at the little white marks with ecstasy.
"Because if you are, and if these objects are what you say they are, the mummy of Sebek-Hotep is an absolutely unique specimen."
"I am quite certain of it," said Thorndyke.
"Then," said Dr. Norbury, "we have made a discovery, thanks to your inquiring spirit." Poor John Bellingham! He little knew what a treasure he was giving us. How I wish he could have known! How I wish he could have been here with us tonight!"
He paused once more to gaze in rapture at the photograph. And then Thorndyke, in his quiet, impassive way, said, "John Bellingham is here, Dr. Norbury. This is John Bellingham." Dr. Norbury started back and stared at Thorndyke in speechless amazement.
"You don't mean," he exclaimed after a long pause, "that this mummy is the body of John Bellingham?"
"I do indeed. There is no doubt of it."
"But it is impossible. The mummy was here in the gallery a full 3 weeks before he disappeared."
"Not so," said Thorndyke. "John Bellingham was last seen alive by you and Mr. Jellicoe on the 14th of October, more than 3 weeks before the mummy left Queen Square. After that date, he was never seen, alive or dead, by any person who knew him and could identify him." Dr. Norbury reflected a while in silence. Then, in a faint voice, he asked,
"How do you suggest that John Bellingham's body came to be inside that cartonnage?"
"I think Mr. Jellicoe is the most likely person to be able to answer that question," Thorndyke replied dryly. There was another interval of silence, and then Dr. Norbury asked suddenly,
"But what do you suppose has become of Sebek-Hotep? The real Sebek-Hotep, I mean."
"I take it," said Thorndyke, "that the remains of Sebek-Hotep, or at least a portion of them, are at present lying in the Woodford mortuary, awaiting an adjourned inquest." As Thorndyke made this statement, a flash of belated intelligence, mingled with self-contempt, fell on me. Now that the explanation was given, how obvious it was! And yet I, a competent anatomist and physiologist, and actually a pupil of Thorndyke's, had mistaken those ancient bones for the remains of a recent body. Dr. Norbury considered the last statement for some time in evident perplexity.
"It is all consistent enough, I must admit," he said at length. "And yet, are you quite sure there is no mistake? It seems so incredible."
"There is no mistake, I assure you," Thorndyke answered. "To convince you, I will give you the facts in detail. First, as to the teeth. I have seen John Bellingham's dentist and obtained particulars from his casebook. There were, in all, 5 teeth that had been filled. The right upper wisdom tooth, the molar next to it, and the second lower molar on the left side had all extensive gold fillings. You can see them quite plainly in the skiagraph. The second lower lateral incisor had a very small gold filling, which you can see as a nearly circular white dot. In addition to these, a filling of tin amalgam had been inserted while the deceased was abroad, in the second left upper bicuspid, the rather gray spot that we have already noticed. These would by themselves furnish ample means of identification, but in addition there is the tattooed device of the Eye of Osiris."
"Horus," murmured Dr. Norbury.
"Horus, then, in the exact locality in which it was borne by the deceased, and tattooed, apparently, with the same pigment. There are further the suture wires in the kneecaps. Sir Morgan Bennett, having looked up the notes of the operation, informs me that he introduced 3 suture wires into the left patella and 2 into the right, which is what the skiagraph shows. Lastly, the deceased had an old Pott's fracture on the left side. It is not very apparent now, but I saw it quite distinctly just now when the shadows of the bones were whiter. I think you may take it that the identification is beyond all doubt or question."
"Yes," agreed Dr. Norbury with gloomy resignation. "It sounds, as you say, quite conclusive. Well, well, it is a most horrible affair. Poor old John Bellingham! It looks uncommonly as if he had met with foul play. Don't you think so?"
"I do," replied Thorndyke. "There was a mark on the right side of the skull that looked rather like a fracture. It was not very clear, being at the side, but we must develop up the next negative to show it."
Dr. Norbury drew his breath in sharply through his teeth.
"This is a gruesome business, Doctor," said he. "A terrible business. Awkward for our people, too. By the way, what is our position in the matter? What steps ought we to take?"
"You should give notice to the coroner. I will manage the police, and you should communicate with one of the executors of the will."
"Mr. Jellicoe?"
"No, not Mr. Jellicoe, under the peculiar circumstances. You had better write to Mr. Godfrey Bellingham."
"But I rather understood that Mr. Hurst was the co-executor," said Dr. Norbury.
"He is, surely, as matters stand," said Jervis.
"Not at all," replied Thorndyke. "He was, as matters stood, but he is not now. You are forgetting the conditions of Clause 2. That clause sets forth the conditions under which Godfrey Bellingham shall inherit the bulk of the estate and become the co-executor. And those conditions are that the body of the testator shall be deposited in some authorized place for the reception of the bodies of the dead, situate within the boundaries of, or appertaining to some place of worship within, the parish of St. George, Bloomsbury, and St. Giles in the Fields, or St. Andrew above the bars, and St. George the Martyr. Now, Egyptian mummies are the bodies of the dead, and this museum is an authorized place for their reception. And this building is situate within the boundaries of the parish of St. George, Bloomsbury. Therefore, the provisions of Clause 2 have been duly carried out, and therefore Godfrey Bellingham is the principal beneficiary under the will, and the co-executor, in accordance with the wishes of the testator. Is that quite clear?"
"Perfectly," said Dr. Norbury. "And a most astonishing coincidence. But, my dear young lady, had you not better sit down? You are looking very ill."
He glanced anxiously at Ruth, who was pale to the lips and was now leaning heavily on my arm.
"I think, Barclay," said Thorndyke, "you had better take Miss Bellingham out into the gallery, where there is more air. This has been a tremendous climax to all the trials that she has borne so bravely."
"Go out with Barclay," he added gently, laying his hand on her shoulder, "and sit down while we develop the other negatives. You mustn't break down now, you know, when the storm is past and the sun is beginning to shine." He held the door open, and as we passed out, his face softened into a smile of infinite kindness.
"You won't mind my locking you out," said he. "This is a photographic dark room at present."
The key grated in the lock, and we turned away into the dim gallery. It was not quite dark, for a beam of moonlight filtered in here and there through the blinds that covered the skylights. We walked on slowly, her arm linked in mine, and for a while neither of us spoke. The great rooms were very silent and peaceful and solemn. The hush, the stillness, the mystery of the half-seen forms in the cases around, were all in harmony with the deeply felt sense of a great deliverance that filled our hearts. We had passed through into the next room before either of us broke the silence. Insensibly our hands had crept together, and as they met and clasped with mutual pressure, Ruth exclaimed, "How dreadful and tragic it is! Poor, poor Uncle John! It seems as if he had come back from the world of shadows to tell us of this awful thing. But, oh God, what a relief it is! She caught her breath in one or two quick sobs and pressed my hand passionately. "It is over, dearest," I said. "It is gone forever. Nothing remains but the memory of your sorrow and your noble courage and patience." "I can't realize it yet," she murmured. "It has been like a frightful, interminable dream." "Let us put it away," said I, "and think only of the happy life that is opening." She made no reply, and only a quick catch in her breath now and again told of the long agony that she had endured with such heroic calm. We walked on slowly, scarcely disturbing the silence with our soft footfalls, through the wide doorway into the second room. The vague shapes of the mummy cases, standing erect in the wall cases, loomed out dim and gigantic, silent watchers keeping their vigil with the memories of untold centuries locked in their shadowy breasts. They were an awesome company. Reverend survivors from a vanished world, they looked out from the gloom of their abiding place, but with no shade of menace or of malice in their silent presence. Rather, with a solemn benison on the fleeting creatures of today. Halfway along the room, a ghostly figure, somewhat aloof from its companions, showed a dim, pallid blotch where its face would have been. With one accord, we halted before it. "Do you know who it is, Ruth?" I asked.
"Of course I do," she answered. "It is Artemidorus."
We stood, hand in hand, facing the mummy, letting our memories fill in the vague silhouette with its well-remembered details. Presently, I drew her nearer to me and whispered, "Ruth, do you remember when we last stood here?" "As if I could ever forget," she answered passionately. "Oh, Paul, the sorrow of it, the misery! How it wrung my heart to tell you! Were you very unhappy when I left you?" "Unhappy? I never knew until then what real heartbreaking sorrow was. It seemed as if the light had gone out of my life forever. But there was just one little spot of brightness left."
"What was that?"
"You made me a promise, dear. A solemn promise. And I felt, at least I hoped, that the day would come, if I only waited patiently, when you would be able to redeem it." She crept closer to me, and yet closer, until her head nestled on my shoulder and her soft cheek lay against mine. "Dear heart," I whispered, "is it now? Is the time fulfilled?"
"Yes, dearest," she murmured softly. "It is now and forever."
Reverently, I folded her in my arms, gathered her to the heart that worshipped her utterly. Henceforth, no sorrows could hurt us, no misfortunes vex, for we should walk hand in hand on our earthly pilgrimage and find the way all too short. Time, whose sands run out with such unequal swiftness for the just and the unjust, the happy and the wretched, lagged, no doubt, with the toilers in the room that we had left. But for us its golden grains trickled out apace and left the glass empty before we had begun to mark their passage. The turning of a key and the opening of a door aroused us from our dream of perfect happiness. Ruth raised her head to listen, and our lips met for one brief moment. Then, with a silent greeting to the friend who had looked on our grief and witnessed our final happiness, we turned and retraced our steps quickly, filling the great empty rooms with chattering echoes.
"We won't go back into the dark room, which isn't dark now," said Ruth. "Why not?" I asked. "Because when I came out, I was very pale, and I'm... well, I don't think I am very pale now. Besides, poor Uncle John is in there, and I should be ashamed to look at him with my selfish heart overflowing with happiness."
"You needn't be," said I. "It is the day of our lives, and we have a right to be happy. But you shan't go in if you don't wish to."
And I accordingly steered her adroitly past the beam of light that streamed from the open door.
"We have developed 4 negatives," said Thorndyke, as he emerged with the others, "and I am leaving them in the custody of Dr. Norbury, who will sign each when they are dry, as they may have to be put into evidence. What are you going to do?"
I looked at Ruth to see what she wished.
"If you won't think me ungrateful," said she, "I would rather be alone with my father tonight. He is very weak and..."
"Yes, I understand," I said hastily, and I did.
Mr. Bellingham was a man of strong emotions, and would probably be somewhat overcome by the sudden change of fortune and the news of his brother's tragic death.
"In that case," said Thorndyke, "I will bespeak your services. Will you go on and wait for me at my chambers when you have seen Miss Bellingham home?"
I agreed to this, and we set forth under the guidance of Dr. Norbury, who carried an electric lamp, to return by the way we had come, 2 of us at least, in a vastly different frame of mind. The party broke up at the entrance gates, and as Thorndyke wished my companion good night, she held his hand and looked up in his face with swimming eyes.
"I haven't thanked you, Dr. Thorndyke," she said, "and I don't feel that I ever can. What you have done for me and my father is beyond all thanks. You have saved his life, and you have rescued me from the most horrible ignominy. Goodbye, and God bless you."
The hansom that bowled along eastward, at most unnecessary speed, bore 2 of the happiest human beings within the wide boundaries of the town. I looked at my companion as the lights of the street shone into the cab, and was astonished at the transformation. The pallor of her cheek had given place to a rosy pink. The hardness, the tension, the haggard self-repression that had aged her face were all gone, and the girlish sweetness that had so bewitched me during the early days of our love had stolen back. Even the dimple was there when the sweeping lashes lifted and her eyes met mine in a smile of infinite tenderness. Little was said on that brief journey. It was happiness enough to sit, hand clasped in hand, and know that our time of trial was past, that no cross of fate could ever part us now. The astonished cabman set us down, according to instructions, at the entrance to Neville's Court, and watched us with open mouth as we vanished into the narrow passage. The court had settled down for the night, and no one marked our return. No curious eye looked down on us from the dark house front as we said goodbye just inside the gate.
"You will come and see us tomorrow, dear, won't you?" she asked.
"Do you think it possible that I could stay away then?"
"I hope not. But come as early as you can. My father will be positively frantic to see you, because I shall have told him, you know. And remember that it is you who have brought us this great deliverance. Good night, Paul."
"Good night, sweetheart." She put up her face frankly to be kissed, and then ran up to the ancient door, whence she waved me a last goodbye. The shabby gate in the wall closed behind me and hid her from my sight. But the light of her love went with me and turned the dull street into a path of glory. End of chapter 18.